This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Your influence in this region is deeper and wider than that of any other writer. We have known you for a long time, and from the first contact with your ideas, their appeal grew deeper until our publishing houses were working daily to translate and print your work. You are the only Western writer that all Arab newspapers follow closely.
Are listening to New Books in Intellectual History. I'm your host, David Goodhertz, and my guest today is Yoav Di Kapua, author of No Exit, Arab Existentialism, Jean-Paul Sartre, and Decolonization. The words you heard him read up at the top came from an Egyptian journalist writing to Sartre in March of 1967, during the French philosopher's highly publicized and highly politicized visit to Egypt. This visit frames Di Kapua's work, but No Exit is about much more than Sartre's influence in the Arab world. It is a groundbreaking work of global intellectual history that recovers the voices of poets, philosophers, and political thinkers from around the Arab world who delved into what Di Kapua calls the most elusive aspect of decolonization, the question of being in the wake of empire. A small note before we begin, I spoke with Professor Di Kapua before the March of Return at the Gaza border brought Palestinian refugees back onto the front page of American newspapers. These events are yet another reminder, if any is needed, of why books like this are so important. Books that go beyond the headlines and deepen our understanding of a culture, a history, and an existential condition that are often discussed in the most crude and reductive terms. To start things off, I thought I'd just give a very brief summary of the book so listeners can get a sense of what we're talking about. And then after that, we can sort of dive into more detail about how you wrote it, why you wrote it, some major themes of the work, and maybe ultimately, you know, where you see yourself going next. So as the title suggests, No Exit, Arab Existentialism, Jean-Paul Sartre, and Decolonization recovers the history of a little-known and really fascinating existentialist culture that spread across the Middle East after World War II. It's a truly global intellectual history that takes us from Paris to Cairo, Jerusalem, New York, Bethlehem, Beirut. And along the way, we meet a whole galaxy of artists, literary critics, political theorists, and philosophers who used existentialism or reinvented existentialism, really, to redefine their culture, decolonize their minds, or in some cases, just to defend their right to misbehave. If that wasn't enough, there's also a kind of historical whodunit tucked in there, in which we try to solve a philosophical mystery. Why did Sartre, who was the most opinionated and judgmental man in the world at the time, and also a great hero of anti-colonial struggles, fail to develop a clear position on the Israel-Palestine conflict? We're not going to give you the answer to that question during this conversation. Our focus really is going to be on Arab existentialism itself, because the heroes of this book are the Arab existentialists. And as I was reading it, I found myself really wondering, you know, why haven't I heard about them before? Where have these great philosophers been hiding? So I guess that's also my first question for you. How did you find them, and how did you end up writing the story of Arab existentialism?
Right, we have a very interesting historiographical phenomenon happening in Middle Eastern studies. We have very good histories of the region, of specific areas in the region, and intellectual histories leading to the 1950s, that is, from the 19th century into the 1950s. Then we have a break, a suspicious hiatus for the 50s and 60s, and everything is picked up again after the 1967 war, which is, of course, a major watershed in the history of the region, the war between the Israelis and the Arabs. And I was wondering, why the gap, and what is it in the history of the post-1967 period that makes it very easy for historians to divide it to before and after? As 67 is a major defeat of something in which we can describe the so-called secular Arab world. I don't really accept these definitions, but so-called secular Arab world that became Islamic and fundamentalist after that we had a universal engagement with the world. And after 67, we got this localism and a whole other host of sort of divisions of before and after. So the 50s and 60s were quite an historiographical enigma for me. And I decided to read broadly about the 50s and 60s, that it just go without, you know, just sit 2-3 years and read. And it's then that I found that existentialism is very, very prevalent and the relationship with Sartre is substantial. So I can use this as a platform, not as the most important thing that happened during this period, but as a platform that can allow us to rethink the 50s and 60s, which is an era of decolonization, which opens up basically the Middle East to the era of decolonization, the global South, the global 60s. So we're no longer putting the Middle East in some ghetto. We can think about it in tandem with other developments, and that actually changes the story we know about the 50s and 60s.
Right. So what kind of things do we get to see when we take the Middle East out of the ghetto and reconstruct this multi-directional dialogue with Europe? Yes, but also with decolonization movements in Africa and Asia and around the world. You know, what new kind of understanding can we gain from that?
Yeah, so the way in which the Middle East was, you know, involved in global developments, not only those related to France, but those related to struggles of liberation in Africa and Asia, was always known. What we did not know is the extent of the connections and how intense are these connections and meaningful they were. Now, I did not set to write a book about global intellectual history. I did not sit and say, okay, now I'm going to write a book about global intellectual history. I'm going to show this and this and that. The way it worked was the other way around. I started digging in the backyard of the Middle East, where we always dig as Middle East historians. And the stories took me to other places. Specifically, in the beginning, it took me to France when I followed a group of young intellectuals. It's a generational story. It's a generations of Arab intellectuals who were born in the 1920s and hoped to decolonize their societies. And it's there where they found something which was very amorphous, very difficult to define. Existentialism is notoriously difficult to, you know, to define and pin down. And basically, they took bits and parts of it and reinvented a new tradition, which one of their philosophers, Abdulrahman Badawi, coined and called Arab existentialism. So this is how I got to this connection. And I want to say this is not a passive history of reception studies. That is, Arabs took some idea that Europeans invented and put it to work, so to speak. There is a two-way relationship here. They serve as a model for Europeans on the left for a variety of reasons. And there is a sense that at least those who are engaged in this project are engaged in a universal effort, in a global effort of universal emancipation, of universal citizenship. And that's what is distinctive about that for me.
So let's say I'm an ideological tourist. I'm a man of the left, and I'm coming from Europe, let's say from France, and I'm heading to the Middle East to find some new model for revolutionary activity. You know, what is it that's going to really grab me when I get there? What's going to excite me? What kinds of existentialist philosophy might I find in a bookstore somewhere that I'd want to pick up and throw in my knapsack and bring back to all my Gauloise-smoking Sartrean friends back in Paris?
So if you're a tourist traveling to, ideological tourist travel to the Middle East, I'm not sure that existentialism is that which is going to necessarily impress you, even though I wrote a book about it. Mostly you would look at ways in which the working class is organized. You would look at legislation, how, for example, they made sure that women would get out of the house to work, that they would get training, that they would have maternity leave, that they would have very progressive, especially in Egypt, very progressive legislation, even by today's standards. You would look at agrarian reform. They were impressed by it, the way in which land was taken from landowners and was given to peasants, the way in which peasant communities were reorganized to create better hygiene conditions and a better better infrastructure and better education opportunities. And you would look at the ways in which the Arab world is trying to participate in third world liberation struggles in Africa. That were the things that impressed you. But the presence of existentialism, in case you read Arabic, would not be lost on you. What it did create, maybe we will transition to the usages of existentialism, at least in the 60s, it assisted in creating a common language. But if you come from France, as Sartre, Beauvoir, and Lanzmann, and their entourage, and others came to the Middle East, if you come to the Middle East, they would not be talking in two different languages, something which did happen in the 40s and 50s. They would actually be able to communicate under one conceptual language of the global South and the need for emancipation and the need for revolution and the need for socialism. And existentialism assisted in transitioning the Middle East from a very kind of limited conversation about national liberation and anti-colonial nationalism to something which is much broader and connected also to race, to otherness, to struggles of equality and social justice.
Right. So I think what I hear you saying is that existentialism was sort of a unifying discourse in that it both brought together people from lots of different places, but also ideas and themes that were present in lots of other discussions at the time. So maybe now would be the moment to sort of dive in and talk about the four or five different strands of existentialism that you discuss in detail in your book.
Right. So when we're looking at the various usages of existentialism at the various recreation of kind of micro traditions, we can talk about four or five different clusters that don't necessarily work harmoniously as one system of thought, but more like an open code culture in which you can come and change and add and operate in the world. The first one is a purely philosophical strand. That was by definition limited because it was quite esoteric. It started with the application of Heidegger, with the translation of Heidegger, and with the engagement of categories that relate to authenticity and to the idea of being as a whole, and led to philosophical experimentation that was supposed to create a new philosophy for decolonization that would transition Arab culture and Arab philosophy from its submission to European epistemology to basically a freestanding status in which it is organic to the Arab experience. That is, it does not have a schism between tradition and modernity, but allows for a reconciliation of the two in the form of Sufism, for example. So that was one trend. The second trend was already very, very political, and it was about taking Sartre's notion of commitment, translating it as iltizam, which in Arabic means a commitment, and that is the demand that the object of any form of intellectual work would be concrete political and social change. That is, you don't write a poem for the sake of the poetic emotional value of it, of being simply moving and beautiful, you write a poem that would invoke the struggle of the working class or the peasants or other issues in society and point out the justness of this cause and also the way to change it. That was probably the most prolific platform and the most contagious, in a way, idea that spread all over Arab societies very, very quickly. It started in Cairo, moved to Beirut, and then was dominant feature of Arab thought and politics from bottom to the top all the way to the late 60s when it was replaced with the Palestinian notions of resistance, Mukawama. Another usage of existentialism was related to third worldism. That is, through a conversation about otherness and authentic being, and what does it mean to live a life that is true to your own past, which is a major question in colonial, in society coming societies that are emerging out of colonial rule. Through this, a whole cluster of thought that is called existential humanism, that included not only Sartre, but included Fanon and Memmi and others, and work on racism, on neocolonialism, notions of settler colonialism, struggles for race, for social justice, all of them begin to be conceived under the same umbrella. And here, the issue is not simply intellectual, but also a political example. Because this body of work was applied politically. It was applied to Algeria, as it applied to Vietnam, and to struggles in Rhodesia and Congo. And also, of course, became applicable to Palestine. The other tradition of existentialism is not everything worked against neocolonialism and imperial rule. Existentialism was also used as a tool for opposition against political authoritarianism inside the Middle East. It so happens that societies that go under through decolonization in the 50s and 60s did not notice that nationalism is confused with state power. And while everybody is nationalist, the state becomes stronger. A very small circle of people control it, mostly coming from the previous liberation movement or from the army. And they suppress, you know, the liberal freedoms that were still a legacy of the 30s and 40s in the Middle East. And a whole group of writers began to use themes of existentialism as a philosophy of freedom to point out what the state is doing, point out the reduction in liberal freedoms. And also Palestinian refugees used it to point out their own condition of being a refugee, of being out of state, of being nowhere and being everywhere at the same time. Feminist writers used it in order to expose the works of patriarchy. So it got all sorts of usages. In Baghdad, for example, it was a complete scene of non-engagement with the state, non-engagement with nationalism, and being basically a vagabond intellectual who who live a life that is very similar to what they thought is left bank intellectuals in Paris were doing. Alcohol, sex, smoking, and behavior of that type. So these are the kind of manifestations and usages of it, some of them.
That's terrific. Now, we're obviously not going to be able to get into all the fascinating specific examples of these different streams. And if listeners are interested in that, they'll have to buy the book. But let's focus in here on some of the Palestinian usages of existentialism. As you were talking about the experience of existential homelessness, a quote from your book came to mind. It's from a young Palestinian author whose name was Jabra, Ibrahim Jabra. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And he wrote, We lost Palestine because we had confronted a ruthless modern force with an outmoded tradition. Everything had to change, and change had to begin at the base, with a change of vision, a new way of looking at the things, a new way of saying things, a new way of approaching and portraying man and the world. So maybe we could use that quote as a jumping-off point to ask, how did existentialism give Palestinians a new way of looking at things, a new way of saying things? How did it help them approach the world in a new way?
Right. It's a very good question, because what you hear in this quote is a quest, a yearning for a new ontological position, a new ontology of the post-colonial generation, of those who are supposed to decolonize their society, understanding that decolonization is not, as the previous generation thought, something you do against the colonizers, sort of an outward move, but it's an internal move of purging, of recreation and reinventing a new form of being, or as they called it, a new Arab man. Palestinians were not the only one doing that. A lot of Baathi intellectuals in Syria were doing that, and I tell their stories as well. But what Palestinians were very sensitive doing, because they had no society that is living in one place under one national circumstances, they are intimate outsiders of all other societies in the Middle East. And as such, they have a view from nowhere. And it's interesting that the theorization of the next stage of what does it mean to be free mostly manifested eventually in Palestinian history after 1967, started by people like Fayez Sayer, who was a refugee from Tiberias in the north of Palestine, present-day Israel, and an existentialist philosopher. And he, like Hisham Sharabi, another philosopher, Palestinian philosopher, they were trained as existentialist philosophers on a PhD level in the U.S., both of them, and both of them wrote quite clearly and quite powerfully about the kind of change that is needed in Palestinian society by an Arab society as a whole. Fayez Sayer, for example, did not write about abstractions, because for them things had to be concrete. The existential framework opened them to all sorts of questions, as I mentioned, this race, understanding what is called today intersectionality, right? What is happening with the Black Power movement in the U.S., with post-slavery life in the U.S., with inner life cities in the U.S. They understood that, and they came up with the notion of settler colonialism, which was something that developed in France, but was really theorized and put to work by Fayez Sayer in a book that became an international books bestseller. And that is something that he applied to Palestine, which really, when you look at the philosophical kind of background that brought him to that, his upbringing as an existentialist philosopher and the way in which he understood the human condition brought him to theorize Palestinian destitute in the context of settler colonialism, and demanding from Sartre action. And that was a novelty. Take it to the global level by calling on the first global intellectual to intervene.
And so what does it mean to describe the situation in Palestine in terms of settler colonialism? How is this an innovation that was linked to his existentialist training?
The real innovation here is that this is derived from the notion of otherness. And here it's actually intellectually very fascinating, because one of the ways in which, the other in Western philosophy becomes a major philosophical issue after World War II. It's not so much an issue before, but it is the philosophical problem of the post-war era and continues all the way to our present day, right? Arab intellectuals know that Sartre engaged with this question. He engaged with this question in a text that is a haunting text, because it's a text about Jewish experience of anti-Semitism. Sartre publishes Anti-Semite and Jew, Reflexion sur la question juive. And this book, he theorizes otherness. He shows what does it mean to be for the Jew an other of the anti-Semitic. And he shows that this is a relational, this is a relation. That is, that the otherness of the Jew is constituted as part of a process. This process of how the other is constituted was very effective, not only for West African intellectuals who said, oh, of course, this is how we became, you know, the black other. This is how we became colonized. Fanon read this, and all read this, and the Journal of Présence Africaine, they make a big deal of it. All of this is well known. Simone de Beauvoir is taking the same notion to apply to the process by which the woman becomes a woman, right? She's not born a woman. She becomes a woman. All of this, in that context, was predicated on Sartre's text about anti-Semitism. These texts have been translated to Arabic only last year. It hasn't been translated at all at the time, but they read it, and they negotiated it, and they were not sure how to approach it. What they take out of it is the notion of otherness. This otherness is then conjoined with the idea of race, and with the idea that Zionism have others, and the others of Zionism are Palestinians, and the issue is racial. That is, Zionism is a racist environment, that's the way the phrase, is a racist movement, that's the way it was framed, that others Palestinians as racial others, and that opens, that connects the Palestinian cause intellectually to all the conversation that happened in the 60s about racism and colonialism and racism and imperialism, connects them directly to the black American experience. Of course, Algeria, of course, Rhodesia, Congo, all the struggles of liberation in Africa and other places. So race becomes constitutive of the Palestinian cause with relation to Zionism. And then they coin something, the Faisal does something very simple. He basically says Zionism is racism. He got to it through Sartre. And in the 60s, it seemed okay, it might not be a big deal. You know, it's what happens in colonialism and settler colonialism is a racial reality that makes one group see the other as racially inferior, and hence they have almost a moral justification to remove them from their land as kind of ontologically unequal. But while in the 60s it does not seem to be a big case, in the 70s, all of a sudden, this passes as a UN resolution that Zionism is racism. So eventually, it becomes a major issue, and one of the most painful arguments against Zionism, and something that Zionists really struggled with.
And so, was the idea behind getting Sartre to come to Palestine to get him to say, you know, Zionism is racism according to my own theories of otherness? Was that the motivation behind this trip that sort of frames your work?
Actually not, surprisingly. I thought that, you know, Palestine is at the forefront of this, but the people who bring Sartre eventually to the region are Egyptians. And it's the Egyptian state and Egyptian students in Paris. And really what they want, the thing that is really, really preoccupies them is recognition for their own revolutionary position. How come Sartre wrote a book about Castro? How come he's very much impressed with what is happening in China, but he overlooks the Egyptian revolutionary project? How come Egyptian socialism, Arab socialism, as it was called, is not recognized globally yet as a model to be followed? This is, the Egyptians really want recognition for that, and you can see it not only because of the archival record and so on, you can actually see the way they take Sartre, Beauvoir, and Lanzmann around Egypt is to showcase this revolutionary project. But of course, these people also cared, especially Lutfi El-Houli and his wife, Lilian, they deeply cared about what is happening in Palestine. And they insist that he would visit the Gaza Strip as well. Now, what they want from him, and the Arabs are not one front here. Jordanians and Syrians and Palestinians themselves are pushing against the Egyptians. They feel that the Egyptians are not pulling Palestine at the front. So Billy Dries believes that from Beirut, very influential editor of El Adab, feels that the Egyptians are cutting corners on the Palestinian issue. By the way, it's a chronic Palestinian complaint. It's not something that is new. You can trace it all the way to present day politics. And what they want from Sartre is simply to see that everything that he said about Algeria and Rhodesia is also true in Palestine. Every analysis, any analysis of the way the colonizer works in Algeria, not only the economic system, the racial system, is actually happening in Palestine. That when he writes about race and about otherness and about alienation, this has happened to Palestinians. That is that Zionists have others, and the others are Palestinians. So if the solution in Algeria is dismantling the state of colonialism and the privileges of the pieds noirs, why is it not the solution in Palestine? This, philosophically, is a very, very difficult question to answer for Sartre, and he does not have an answer to it.
Right. Right. Now, I don't want to spoil the end of the book by telling our listeners what Sartre's non-answer actually consists of. So instead, maybe let's go back for a moment. You mentioned that there was a shift away from an existentialist understanding commitment towards a more specifically Palestinian notion of resistance. And I wonder if you maybe could just say a little bit more about that. Is that something that happens post-67? What's the difference between the notion of commitment spreading through the Arab world in the 50s and 60s and what emerges immediately afterward?
So from the get-go, iltizam, commitment, was a contested concept. When you do a conceptual history of iltizam, as I do in the book, you find out that, yes, one tradition was the one I described in which the nationalists, those who wanted a big pan-Arab state and were working on behalf of the Egyptian, expanding Egyptian state or trans-regional Egyptian state of pan-Arabism, they had one notion of commitment. But then the communists and the Marxists came with a competing notion that was also called iltizam, but was actually predicated on the aesthetic and intellectual procedures of socialist realism and of the example of Soviet communism. And there was a party behind it, not a state. Palestinians beginning to see that this notion of commitment, and not only them, is being appropriated by the state and by the various states, in which the state now is saying, we are committed to a cause. Our cause is revolution. It's quite abstract. It's not only our cause is to liberate Palestine. They say our cause is revolution. We're going to change everything. We're going to create a new Arab men and women. We're going to change the structure of society, and for that you have to be committed, but committed to us, right? And when they look at it, they say, hey, this gives a lot of power to the hands of the state. It's a tool of ideological not coercion, but it's a tool of cohesion. It's a tool of bringing people together in an uncritical way. And the Palestinians are very critical because they can see things from various perspectives at any given time, and they're not aligned with any political system. They under five or more different political systems. So they begin to understand that this form of iltizam is actually submission to state power, and it's quite castrating. What it tells you is that you have to follow the directions of the state, and then Palestine would be liberated. Well, people could have believed in it until 1967. But in 1967, in the course of 5-6 days, this entire cause disappears, collapses into thin air. Who else is going to liberate Palestine now? Iltizam cannot do that. Iltizam bankrupt. It was a tool for coercion. It was a tool that was used on behalf of the Baathists to torture opponents. On behalf of Iltizam, 10,000 activists and intellectuals of the Communist Party in Iraq are slaughtered in 1963. These are the things that happened on behalf of Iltizam. plus the defeated war. So they develop a different notion of commitment, which is called mukawama. It has a different name. It's basically resistance. And it's more in tandem with Che Guevara's example than with anything that preceded it in the Middle East. And it is about guerrilla warfare, and it's about creating urban warfare and taking the fight also to Europe, not only in the Middle East, not only in Palestine, but wherever there is a Zionist embassy or you know, an airline or anything that represents the state of Israel is a legitimate target also within Europe. So this is what happened with the notion of mukawama in the hands of Palestinians, and it's coming out of the culture of this general culture of Islam, but also departs from it in considerable ways.
Okay, we're getting close to the end here, and I'm going to let you go in a second, but I just wanted to ask you two last questions. The first is whether you think this trajectory of ilitizam or existentialist commitment more broadly parallels developments in Europe or maybe in the Americas where similar ideas took hold, or is it really a significant departure from other ways of thinking about engagement? And secondly, I guess, what's next, you know? What's the next thing that you want to be focusing on? And what's the next thing that you think intellectual historians ought to focus on once they finish reading your book?
Right. So with regard to the first question, the tradition of ilitizam in the Middle East and its specificity, the specificity of commitment, it is unlike anything that happens in other society. It is really one of these examples in which global intellectual history can show us something which is on the local level very complex, but also on the global international level complex. And if you disconnect this connection, if you don't view it as an intellectual ecosystem, you actually cannot understand how it works. And that's the beauty of global intellectual history. Now, one of the things that happened with commitment in the Middle East, that it's not only against the colonizer, against outside forces, but it also was a tool in which the young generation made space for itself within the literary intellectual field against the old generation of intellectuals. They told them, you're not committed, you're a reactionary, therefore, and they shamed them and chased them out of their positions. Their journals went out of print and new journals came in. So there's a change of the intellectual guard. This is a tool for internal decolonization. So it's when we combine, it's only when we are able to understand the complexity of the idea that is being, in which they are being exposed in Europe, in the way in which they put it in the Middle East in an entirely different way, but also in conversation, that these usages and the functioning of decolonization as a global phenomena becomes clear. Now, with relation to where to take the project next, you know, what do we take from it? This is, of course, very complex because it puts us in a normative space. That is, what kind of histories ought to be written? That's a question you ask someone who is like 80 years old, yeah? and, you know, to tell people what kind of histories to be, you know, we need and so on is not something you know, I'd like to do, or it doesn't actually have any meaning. If you remember, in the 1960s, they had history classes that started with title "Problem in Social History," you know, problems in social history, things like this. And social historians were asked to identify a problem, not to come with a theory, but to identify a problem. I think that if we read the intellectual record and identify concerns, identify problems of the people on the ground, and trace them, we are going to do very good service for understanding the Arab human condition in the 20th century and its context. And I think that's a worthwhile thing to do, not only scholarly, but also politically. It's very important to humanize, to present this full-fledged history that is completely absent from any representation of Arabs today, or, you know, one is mentioned, any country in the Middle East, and the next sentence is some pejorative something. And we do not understand how we got to the Middle East that we have today. In order to understand this Middle East we have today, we really need to begin to humanize even, you know, issues that relate to defeat and collapses of projects. And I think this is one of the benefits of doing this kind of work.
Okay, that's it. Thank you so much, Yoav Di Kapua. The book is called No Exit, Arab Existentialism, Jean-Paul Sartre, and Decolonization. Go and get it. It's out on New Chicago Press now. And we're going to close things out here with a bit from the second movement of the Little Modernsky Suite. So long. Yeah.